97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
All right, we're going to cover what the Fed did a little bit later with Dave Simons, the host of Dollars and Cents on KMOX. I have an audio cut of the day. It's hard for me, and I think we're going to play this with our next guest to get away from the ridiculous answer that KJP gave to Peter Doocy yesterday. But in due time, ladies and gentlemen, I only welcome in Peter Zane to the program because he's written a little bit recently about the media, and we can plenty to talk about with the way that everything has been treated, even in the last week in the aftermath of the second assassination attempt. He's an editor at Real Clear Investigations, a columnist for Real Clear Politics. And have you written, now this last column that you wrote, Peter, how are you? Welcome to the show, but I had a question.
Shoot.
The piece that you wrote in the New York Times, is that taken from a book that you have written?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
There's a collection of essays edited by Michael Walsh, and it's called Against the Corporate Media. And it's got 42 essays in it. One of them was mine, and mine was okay. The Sins of the Gray Lady.
That's where I was confused, because when I pulled the book up, it didn't say your name. It said edited by Michael Walsh. Now it all makes sense. So we're going to find out a couple of the ways that the press hates you, but you kind of highlighted the New York Times. And look, you wrote something in here that really was relatable, and you probably know this, Peter. I talk about this media bias all the time. But you said that rather than serving as an honest broker whose mission is to provide readers with the information needed to make decisions about important issues, the New York Times instantly puts its thumb on the scale, both in terms of the stories covered and those ignored. And that, by the way, is a very important part, those ignored. By replacing skepticism with ideology, the Times seeks to not inform, but to persuade. Its aim is to not reflect society, but to transform it. And views to the contrary are verboten, beyond the pale of acceptable discourse. Everything you wrote there is completely accurate. But I'd go further, because it's not just the New York Times. It seemingly is all of the legacy media right now, isn't it?
I agree. I mean, I think that the Times is especially important, and people who are not in the media can, wonder why we who are in the media are so obsessed on the New York Times. But part of it is because we know it really does set the agenda for NPR, ABC, Washington Post, the newspapers that pick up its story. So it, to a large degree, not solely, but really sets the agenda for the dominant media. And that's why what it does and what it says is acceptable and not acceptable. Imagine if the New York Times had a whiff of skepticism of Russiagate and it found out early on, which of course it could have, that Hillary Clinton was behind all these charges, which they actually kind of maybe even knew. There was some reporting on that, but they could have snuffed that story out right away. But instead, they ran with it, and they have that kind of power.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I haven't seen this in New York Times, but I'll use the Washington Post as an example because I was rather surprised by something they did recently. So if you go back to the end of May, and I don't know how much you've tracked this, but this is one of my favorite stories here of the last last couple of weeks. The NOAA and the climate alarmists out there, Peter, they predicted that this was going to be the worst Atlantic hurricane season like ever in history. Right. And not only has it not been, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been the least active hurricane season in recorded history, the least active. Now, the stories were in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all these things from May and June. Oh, it's going to be a terrible hurricane season. To the Post's credit, the Washington Post, they've done two stories recently that said what happened to the predictions of a, quote, historic hurricane season. That's actually shocking to me, because usually you won't see a clarification on a story that they mess up so much. And that's why when you said what they cover and those ignored is so important, because when they ignored, that's the same thing. They're putting that editorial thumb on the scale and saying, nope, nothing to see here, right?
Well, I'll also tell you, one of the things that I go into is a story that we wrote, Aaron Maté wrote for Real Clear Investigations, that talked about falsehoods in the Russiagate coverage. And we spent a lot of time really going line by line in the coverage that the Post and the Times submitted to win a Pulitzer Prize. And they are so devious in the ways that they will add small lines with caveats, or sort of flicking at the truth, or maybe an argument against what they're trying to say. So they're devious in that when you go back and say, well, you never said this, they go, well, no, we actually, in the 100 stories that we ran on climate change, one of them actually said there are people who are skeptics. Or in the Russiagate thing, we said one line that's, well, all of this hasn't been completely confirmed. But this gets lost in the broad sweep of what the power of narrative is. And I'll give you the best example. Politico, on that story about the Hunter Biden laptop, says 51 intelligence officers say this is Russian disinformation. You read the story, and it's like, well, they don't know, they haven't seen it. But anybody reading that headline, which was the message that then got picked up everywhere, was they say this is what it is. So you really got to read this stuff closely. They are unbelievably skillful at protecting themselves, at offering a lie while doing just enough to protect themselves so that they can pretend that they actually
Absolutely.
Told the truth.
That is such an accurate statement there. Look, I would say that we're getting an example of all of this right now with what's happening in Springfield, Ohio. Now, I can't tell you that there's people eating, you know, dogs and cats, Haitians, but what I can tell you is there's been some pretty horrible things that have happened in that community, and there is an unwillingness on the part of the New York Times and the rest of the legacy media to actually go and do some reporting and ask people, instead of David Muir citing, this was one of my favorite lines from a week ago, David Muir says, well, we called the city manager. Who the F cares what a stupid city manager that's probably going to vote for Kamala Harris anyway is going to say? That's not reporting. That's not journalism. But that's modern day journalism, apparently, especially when there's an agenda, Peter.
Well, I mean, I would also, this is my next column, so I hope that all of my competitors aren't listening. But, you know, really what you think about is how much time first did we spend on the Arlington Cemetery? And then once that died down, and admittedly Trump mentioned this at the debate, but this has been 10 days, one, you know, just on the claim about the pets, and certainly not on the 20,000 people that have been dumped into this tiny community.
Right.
But, I mean, think about all the things we're not talking about, because the media is focusing the conversation on nonsense. We now have service on the national debt is $1 trillion a year.
I know. Yeah.
There was a report the other day about China is engaged in, you know, warlike conduct with the Philippines, who is a longstanding ally of ours. So, you know, you got to ask yourself, do you want Kamala Harris? Do you think she can stand up to these people? And so what I would take, you know, Elon Musk sent out some tweet about, and he doesn't certainly read what I'm saying in his tweets, but, you know, about the Ohio thing. And I was like, this is a diversion. This is a tactic to get us talking about stuff that doesn't matter so that we don't say to Harris and to Trump, who also is very short on details, you know, what are you going to do? We are a world that is in trouble. We have massive issues, and I don't know when those bills are going to come due, but they're going to. And that's what we should be selecting somebody for, not nonsense about Arlington Cemetery. So that's how they're really devious, is that they focus attention on nonsense to distract us so that we don't ask Kamala in particular the hard question.
What do you think? This is something I highlighted earlier. Maybe I'm kind of, you know, getting too far ahead of myself here because I mentioned I was going to use it for cut of the day. But I thought this was an interesting moment with Peter Doocy and KJP in the press room yesterday.
How many more assassination attempts on Donald Trump until the president and the vice president and you pick a different word to describe Trump other than threat?
Peter, if anything from this administration, I actually completely disagree with the premise of your question. The question that you're asking, it is also incredibly dangerous in the way that you're asking it.
What?
And now for you to make that kind of comment in your question, because your question involved a comment and a statement. And, you know, it is, that is also incredibly dangerous. But when you start bringing political rhetoric, that is not okay.
Okay, so that was a complete word salad. You can kind of hear the wheels spinning, and she didn't know really how to get out of it.
Slowly.
But, you know, the other thing is, and this is what happened at the debate, actually both debates, what I said earlier on the show is I think that they're pretty comfortable at the White House knowing that any kind of exchange like that won't be covered widely at all. When they mention Charlottesville and continue to lie about that, it's not going to matter because no one's going to put that in a clarification or a fact check. So they can get away with a lot of things that the other side probably can't get away with because they're going to just move on and say nothing to see here and protect the Democrats.
Well, and I mean, you know, the other thing that we have to remind ourselves, there's a poll that says 28% of Democrats, you know, think the country would be better off if the assassin's bullet had taken Trump out. So, you know, when you ask them a question like that, they don't see it as heightened rhetoric. They don't see it as dangerous talk. They think he's Hitler. They wish he were dead.
Yeah.
They are sad that that guy stopped, a bunch of them. And so they don't understand, you know, we're looking at it as he's a guy, he's the pick of half the country, he's running for president, you're saying these terrible things, and it could set somebody off. And they think, no, we're describing him. I think they really believe, they believe the nonsense, the ugly things they say about him. And when you do, then, you know, it's like that old question about evil. And, you know, if somebody doesn't think he's evil, if the slave master thinks he's doing the slave a favor because he's civilizing him, is he actually evil if he doesn't have consciousness of evil in his mind? And I just throw that out because they believe all the stuff that they say about him, which is insane. They're deranged. And it's, I don't know how you come back from that.
How do you, I want you to explain this, because when you wrote recently, Peter Zhang is back with us from Real Clear Investigations and Real Clear Politics. You said this about the election. Americans are not facing a choice this November between two competing visions, but about the pace of our decline. Explain that a little bit.
I don't think that Donald Trump is a true conservative. I think he's a much better choice, and I think he will do some good things. But when you think about what's going on with our budget deficits, really what I was getting at was we have become a people who feel entitled. We are a people who feel the government owes us. We are people that have a grievance. And it's not all made up. People have grievance. People may feel they're entitled to certain things. But that question John F. Kennedy asked, ask not what you can do for your what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, that's gone. Trump is a grievance candidate, and I agree he's got a lot to be, you know, to have grievance about. Harris is a grievance candidate. And the traditional mythology of America, and mythology is not always false, is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And that is gone. And if you want to go a step further, the Judeo-Christian tradition of you don't sin. You have a choice about what your actions are. What are you going to do? I'm not saying there aren't a bunch of people that feel that way, but the sweep of this country has rejected that. And there's no choice in the candidates. It's just a question of who they think is screwing you. Is it this side or the other side?
Yeah, and I kind of understand that. No, and I get that. And here, look, I share your concern about the lack of attention to detail with some of these issues. And I'll take you back to 20 years ago when, and this is kind of sad to me, it really is, because I'm someone as a fiscal conservative that has cared about the debt and the deficit. I have cared and talked about extensively Social Security reform and Medicare reform. Social Security reform, perhaps a little easier than the latter. But 20 years ago, I was talking to this guy that is now verboten in Republican politics, Peter. He's just a rhino. He didn't want to talk about anything. We don't want to hear him. He's off the radar. The former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, because I was in Wisconsin, got to know him very well. He was working hard, especially in the latter part of that first Bush administration, to try to actually do something to fix some of these things. We've now kicked the can 20 years. There's no indication, to your point, that we're not going to kick it another 20 or 50 or 100 years. So where does that leave us?
The Wall Street Journal had an editorial or some piece that said we need to act on Social Security. This is the Wall Street Journal, and there was a page of letters, you know, half page, whatever. There were a bunch of letters. Every one of them was, don't you touch it. I'm owed that money. And right. I'm just thinking, you know, no one's willing to sacrifice. I'm not saying people who don't have, if you don't have anything to sacrifice, you can't sacrifice. But nobody, not nobody, but people don't want to step up. They feel they're entitled. They don't feel connected to the state in a way, into the future of the country. And the other thing I was just saying is, like, neither candidate, you know, Trump might be good for small business. He might get rid of regulation. But nobody has the Reagan-esque rhetoric of, I believe in you, and what I want to do is get out of your way. That message has disappeared. And that's what made this country great. That's why people came here from all over the world. And that's why people still come. And as I said in my piece, the irony is that native-born people have largely lost faith in America to a greater extent than the immigrants who come here.
Yeah.
And while we read stories about, oh, they're getting on this welfare program and that, you know, most of these people just, they want to work. They want a job. They just want to be able to take care of themselves. And they believe this country has that opportunity. And I think for many native-born people, you know, that's gone.
Well, you know, I mentioned this last year. I had not been in Western Europe in a while. I was in Barcelona last year and talking in Madrid and talking to some Spanish friends there. I said this when I came back. I said, some of these Europeans have a greater love for America than we do, I think.
Yes. Yeah, they do. I mean, because we still, you know, our great advantage, and this is a terrible advantage, is the rest of the world is in even worse shape. And I mean, really, with Kamala Harris, you know, Europe, the problems in Europe at bottom are, as Margaret Thatcher says, they have run out of other people's money. They are hamstrung. They have played every card. We still have some freedom. We still can run deficits in a way that they can't. So, you know, those bills haven't come due yet. But we, unfortunately, are continuing to mimic and become more like the countries that should be a cautionary tale for
us. Yeah, I agree.
Canary in the coal mine, we're going towards it instead of running from it.
Yep, it's a problem. And I love having conversations like this because I agree wholeheartedly. And I want to read this book. So your essay is in this book called Against the Corporate Media, 42 Ways the Press Hates You. I don't know how Michael would have narrowed it down to just 42 because I think we can go on from there. But that's what sequels are about. But Peter, thank you so much. I got to get a copy of that book. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, take care. That's J. Peter Zane. He writes for Real Clear Investigations and Real Clear Politics. And I talked about him in the last hour. I said I like him because I like thinking people. And, you know, it's not comfortable. No one seemingly, it's not sexy to talk about Social Security reform or Medicare reform. But we're going to talk about this a little bit with Dave Simons coming up. Some of this kind of folds into the next topic because the interest, just the interest on the debt is becoming bigger than our defense budget. And if people don't see what that is a problem, but again, it's not sexy to talk about. No politicians have courage. Both candidates have pretty much written off any discussion about Social Security. And look, I try to emphasize this when I talk about Social Security reform. Maybe it's easy for me to do now that I'm, you know, in the age that wouldn't be affected. But typically when we talk about Social Security reform, we're not talking about anyone over the age of 50. So if you're over the age of 50, you've paid these benefits, nothing is going to be taken away from you. Now, you would not know that. And the reason you wouldn't know it is because I mentioned Paul Ryan. They took out ads against Paul Ryan, throw granny off the cliff. They make it seem like Republicans are trying to steal this, your benefits that you have owed to you, because they lie. And then the media doesn't really want to cover the truth, unfortunately. Speaking of Dave Simons, we'll talk about what happened with the Fed today and how that kind of plays into everything coming up next. Well, just as a programming note, I'm going to take the rest of the week off tomorrow and Friday. Ryan Recker will be sitting in with you. I'll be back on Monday and we'll be full force at that point. I have an audio cut of the day coming up here in just a couple of minutes. It was an interesting day and not completely unexpected, maybe from one standpoint, though, because they weren't sure, the experts, how far the Fed would go. But the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 0.5 percentage points. That's a pretty big move. And I think they feel like they've won the war against inflation. And it seems like more is to come as well. But let's talk about this afternoon with our friend Dave Simons. He's the host of Dollars and Cents on KMOX every weekend. He is the managing director of One Private Wealth in Chesterfield. David, how are you this afternoon?
Well, Mark, thanks for having me on, as always.
Did you think it would be 50 basis points? Was that your expectation?
Well, it was. I don't know if I'm in the minority or not. I will just tell you, in my little corner of the world, we had a friendly wager in the office and this morning, and everybody went with the 25 basis points or a quarter of one. I was the outlier. I'm not saying I was confident in it, but there are a couple of reasons we can explore. But I really did think the Fed would go a little bolder and go with a 0.5%. And as we know, that's exactly what they did.
So then why did they do that? Let me play just a little audio. And it's not the greatest audio, but I'm going to play this here. This is Jay Powell saying something earlier today.
The U.S. economy is in good shape. It's growing at a solid pace. Inflation is coming down. The labor market is in a strong pace. We want to keep it there.
All right. So far be it from me to challenge the experts at the Fed, but a message like this with, a half a point cut really seems to send a signal that, hey, gosh, we're a little bit more worried about the economy than we were previously.
Well, maybe part of it. We have to remember that the Fed has this dual mandate. They are required by law to really address two basic economic issues. That is price stability. That's a fancy way to say inflation or deflation, whatever the case may be. And the other, Mark, is the employment picture. Now, they have spent the last few years, a couple of years anyway, especially fighting that one side on inflation. I could tell a little bit. I have to be careful how I put this because I don't think he's doing a victory lap. But I think Powell and the Fed feel they've done a really good job bringing inflation down. And I can't disagree with that. I think that there is a lot of potential danger out there that they could lose their grip on this. I think they were late to the party, no question. But inflation is clearly trending down. I think they believe their work is largely over there. I think they think inflation is going to continue to come down on its own. Now they're attacking the other side. And what they see is an employment picture in this country, while still pretty good, is deteriorating a little bit. So it's not so much numbers in isolation. It's always trends. Think about that. It's always the trend. And they see that maybe the employment picture is starting to weaken, and they want to get out in front of that, thus your 50 basis point cut today.
Dave Simon's back with us. It's always important to explain to people, even a host like me, who doesn't have full comprehension of what this means. But Dave, it's not the Fed cutting rates doesn't mean that your mortgage rate's going to automatically come down. There's a little correlation. Credit card debt is at an all-time high. Doesn't mean you're going to get a better deal necessarily on your credit card. So explain how this has, implications and sort of rattles through the economy, if you will.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that, Mark. We don't see an immediate type of relief here in any of those things that you mentioned. So we have to take a step back and look at the bigger picture. This is just the start of a rate cut cycle. This is the first shot across the bow. A lot of your economists out there believe that you could get another quarter of 1% in November, and then they meet one more time in December for the year. Could be a half of a percent then. I think they want to bring that the overall yield, if you will, the Fed funds rate down to the low threes, if not the upper twos. Well, after today's cut, it's between 4.75 and 5. Now, back to your question that you were posing there. What that means is this takes a while. I don't think you're going to see much of a relief in credit card interest rates. You'll start to see some of the variable mortgage rates come down. But ultimately, this will not have the positive impact on the economy that the Fed is hoping for until well into next year. So this is just the first little baby step into some economic improvement, especially on the labor side in 2025 and 26.
But kind of this might get into the weeds, but when we hear the Fed rate cut and what that really, really means for businesses, for example, it allows them to borrow money. And this kind of goes to the point of the labor market at a lower cost, right?
That's exactly right. You nailed it. In fact, Jay Powell even addressed that very thing in his speech this afternoon after they made their announcement of the cut. And that is, and I'm kind of putting words in his mouth, but he was referencing the labor environment, which obviously starts with employers. And a lot of your smaller businesses that need debt to keep their business alive in terms of growing have really been priced out with these higher rates, these borrowing rates. Well, no wonder small cap stocks really started to rally right after the announcement. I don't know what they're going to do here after that, but no surprise that they have rallied the most, because now some of these smaller companies that need the debt market, they need the working capital market to operate efficiently for them to continue to grow their business. Well, this was good news for them. And that's really what the Fed was attacking. So that's my main message to all the listeners. The inflation picture isn't anymore in the crosshairs for the Fed. It's now gone over to the labor market and employers making sure they're still hiring.
All right, Dave, but let's kind of talk about the stock market just a little bit and what's happening there, because it's been interesting. I mean, we had a couple of dips and then it's right back now, above 41,000. The Dow did not react extremely well today, though, on this news, right?
No, because that's already been factored in. The market never likes to wait until the actual announcement. it was inevitable that they were going to cut. There was a 100% chance that that was going to happen. We just didn't know how much. So the market had already done its dirty work. It had already done its heavy lifting in advance, because we know the market was back to near all-time highs. So this is kind of a shrug of the shoulders to some degree. I think the half of 1% might have been a little bit of a surprise, but not enough to propel the Dow or the S&P way up. Maybe that comes later, but the initial reaction was, yeah, okay, kind of expecting
it. Yeah. You know, I'm going to tell you how I gauge the economy these days, in the stock market in particular. I don't look at my 401k. I don't even want to look at it, right? I'm going to let it out there. I didn't look at it when it was terrible a few years ago. I'm putting more money into it than I ever have before, because I'm feeling the pressure of retirement in hopefully 10 years, Dave. But, you know, I think I've talked to you about this before. I set up, and this was interesting. It was like a year ago, August. And I know there's a variety of apps, but the one that I use is called Acorns, where when I buy something, like we were at Taco Bell the other day, my daughter, and they said, do you want to round up to the nearest dollar for a charity? And I said, no, I don't want to. And the reason was because I round up in my account and it goes into my Acorns account. And then I put money in there every week. The point of all this is, after a year, you know, it gives me the running tally of where I am from when I started. So right now I'm up 12% from a year ago. Now that's dipped down to, I think, like 6.9% over the past couple of months. And then it goes up to 8. But I mean, if we're averaging like 10% over the last year, that's pretty solid.
Well, it is. Historically, if all of your money is in the stock market, and just by what you said, it doesn't sound like 100% is in the stock market, and that's not necessarily a bad thing if you're within 10 years of retirement, you probably are well diversified. But you're exactly right. At 12% return, and we still have more than a quarter left in the year, so you annualize that. But even what I tell people, look, a reasonable allocation, if you make 6 to 8% a year, you can get wealthy on that over time. You just have to obviously start early, stay with it, and don't give in. You kind of reference this, but don't give in to when the market dips and there are all kinds of panic headlines. Oh, my gosh, you might want to sell out and go. No, don't. Just day in and day out. Mark, some of the great stories that I've seen over my 30-plus years in this business is the person who never made six figures, never made a ton of money, but just blindly and pretty much naively just put money from their paycheck to their 401k year after year, decade after decade. They wake up one day, they're 60-some years old, they're ready to retire and say, how did I get this? I have no idea. I don't even know about the market. All I know is I was blindly putting the money in. I never sold out, never changed, and here I am with X amount of dollars. It works every time it's tried.
It works every time it's tried. And unfortunately, what I feel is happening out there, you and I have talked about this before. Look, I mentioned the credit card debt at all-time high. People are not able to pull equity out of their homes. So what I'm concerned about is, and I think you see this, people are cashing 401ks out more than they ever have been before. So there's panic out there because consumers are running out of cash.
Well, there is something to that, and I think the Fed is also aware of that. And I think that might also have played into their fact that they need to get this half a point down. Here's something else that was not discussed today, but it is something that I'm looking at. And, Mark, it's the interest that we pay on this $36 trillion and then some on the debt, which still the interest, it hadn't been a problem for years and years and years, but now it is, because we have more interest going to pay on this debt than our defense budget. That made the headlines this year. We've got to get that down. Now, on the one side, they need to stop the increase in spending. That's a whole other topic. But on my side of things, on the budgetary side, it's the interest. This will help alleviate that to a little bit. And I know the Fed is not blind to that.
Yeah, such a big story. Look, we kind of buried the lead on this. I'm glad you brought it up, because that is one of the more important aspects of all of this. Dave Simons, awesome. We'll hear you on Camo X and the Dollars and Cents show on Sunday. And thank you so much. And we'll talk soon, David.
Mark, always a treat. Thank you.
And that's why that goes kind of back to the conversation with Peter Zane about the debt. There's nobody. Look, this hasn't come up in a presidential debate. I don't anticipate that whatever sit downs that Kamala Harris or even Trump will have, that someone's going to bring up Social Security or Medicare reform, because everyone's kind of decided we're not going to do that because it's too politically risky, right? You're going to lose your chance at winning the election. Now, there's always a chance. We know that Kamala's going to say all these things because all of a sudden she wants a border wall that she'll back off on if she wins. Maybe the same can be said in the other direction. If Trump would win, maybe he gets down with some people who want to be serious about the deficit and reducing it. And then we have to talk about some tough things. But look, no one in Washington at this point is really interested in tackling the tough issues. And that's going to cost the country dearly in the future. We're coming back. I still have audio cut of the day. Hang in there. All right, one more segment to go here. I have audio cut of the day coming up here in just a moment. Before I get to that, I got a couple of things that I wanted to share. And just as a programming note as well, I will not be here tomorrow and Friday. Ryan Recker will be filling in. He's on location. Ryan moved up to Michigan, but he'll be here via all the technology tomorrow afternoon. I'll be back on Monday. I have a couple of things, I think, here for cut of the day, so I'll hold on that for a second. But I heard Kevin McCarthy, the former speaker on Fox right now, talking about this election, and I think he nailed it. Look, some of you have been with me for a long time, and I made the ill-fated prediction back in 2016, and I said it over and over again, and I could not have been more wrong. I'm kind of like a climatologist. You know, I have the batting average of the climatologist when it comes to politics. I knew that Trump was popular and that there was a movement. I didn't see a path electorally for him to beat Hillary. So I was very defiant. Trump's not going to win. There's no way he can win. Well, I missed a lot of signs there, but it really was because of some big electoral wins, including Pennsylvania. And that's why there's so much attention right now on some of these states like Pennsylvania. Now, Georgia is another one, and Georgia certainly should be winnable from Trump. It wasn't last time. It went to Biden. We know there's been difficulty in Georgia with this guy, Brian Kemp, although they seemingly have made up at this point.
She's trying to convince everyone that she's a moderate who owns a gun, who loves fracking.
So Kevin McCarthy kind of breaking things down, saying he's optimistic still about Trump winning.
I still believe it just comes down to Pennsylvania and Georgia. There are more opportunities for President Trump to win the electoral vote than there are for Kamala Harris. She has a harder time. She's got to play more defense than he does.
I think he's right about that. He kind of gets into details here about the map.
You know what else would be interesting? Let's give Trump Nevada, Arizona. Let's give him, because there are two districts in Maine, he picks up one. But what if he picks up the popular vote there and then add that in? Because then you'll see a whole different outcome.
Well, there's all kinds of options. There's all kinds of outcomes, and it's probably going to go down to the wire. I'm going to miss talking about it on the roundtable. We won't have a Reardon roundtable this week because Ryan will be here, but certainly this is not going away anytime soon. I got this to do here.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right. Well, this one's a little involved, and I played some of this earlier, but there is a mother that was at a hearing on Homeland Security. Patty Morin is his name. Rachel was her daughter, 35-year-old daughter, who was brutally murdered by a migrant. So she testified before this panel earlier today.
They say that the borders are safe. We live 1,800 miles away from the southern border. They're not safe. They're not safe. If you have a sanctuary city in your state, you're not safe.
Yeah, that's why immigration and illegal immigration goes well past the borders down in Mexico, for
sure.
She's
the American mom, and she's not the only one in our cities that have been murdered. There was another murder by an illegal immigrant from El Salvador that happened a year before, and that person was just pleaded guilty to 4 murders, 2 rapes, and numerous other crimes. They are bringing criminals into our country. They are allowing them into our smallest towns, and our people are dying.
Now, at that hearing with Patty Morin and others was this, I don't know who this guy is, David Hathaway. He's from Arizona, and the Democrats must have bribed him to go up there and say ridiculous things.
And I hate to say that, I hate to use the R word, but it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the racism word. There's a xenophobic aspect to this. There was never a proposal to build a wall on the northern border, on the Canadian border. There was never any intent to aggressively enforce Title 42 on the Canadian border. So, you know, there is this kind of racist component to it that we kind of all ignore, but it's there smoldering in the background.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very informed audience. I met many of you, or, you know, was reacquainted with you at the debate watch party. Do I need to even spend one moment on how idiotic that statement was that that guy just said. He's trying to compare what's happening through the southern border with all of Central America and South America and Mexico with Canada, right? I mean, the Canadians might be crossing over here because they can't take Pierre Trudeau or Justin Trudeau, but it's not even close. And that's the Democrats' witness. That was the best that they could do, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Oopsie, I think I hit the wrong one. And that's happened a little bit just because we have different equipment here and we're changing studios. Thankfully for me, this is all going to be done by tomorrow. So I'll be back in the regular studio on Monday. We'll see you then.
Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon KFTK and Instagram at Mark Talk. You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show. Get more at 971talk.com.
All right, one more segment to go here. I have audio cut of the day coming up here in just a moment. Before I get to that, I got a couple things that I wanted to share. And just as a programming note as well, I will not be here tomorrow and Friday. Ryan Recker will be filling in. He's on location. Ryan moved up to Michigan, but he'll be here via all the technology tomorrow afternoon. I'll be back on Monday. I have a couple of things, I think, here for cut of the day, so I'll hold on that for a second. But I heard Kevin McCarthy, the former speaker on Fox right now, talking about this election, and I think he nailed it. Look, some of you have been with me for a long time, and I made the ill-fated prediction back in 2016, and I said it over and over again, and I could not have been more wrong. I'm kind of like a climatologist. You know, I have the batting average of the climatologist when it comes to politics. I knew that Trump was popular and that there was a movement. I didn't see a path electorally for him to beat Hillary. So I was very defiant. Ah, Trump's not going to win. There's no way he can win. Well, I missed a lot of signs there, but it really was because of some big electoral wins, including Pennsylvania. And that's why there's so much attention right now on some of these states like Pennsylvania. Now, Georgia's another one, and Georgia certainly should be winnable from Trump. It wasn't last time. It went to Biden. We know there's been difficulty in Georgia with this guy, Brian Kemp, although they seemingly have made up at this point.
She's trying to convince everyone that she's a moderate who owns a gun, who loves fracking.
So Kevin McCarthy kind of breaking things down, saying he's optimistic still about Trump winning.
I still believe it just comes down to Pennsylvania and Georgia. There are more opportunities for President Trump to win electoral vote than there are for Kamala Harris. She has a harder time. She's got to play more defense than he does.
I think he's right about that. He kind of gets into details here about the map.
You know what else would be interesting? Let's give Trump Nevada, Arizona. Let's give him, because there are two districts in Maine, he picks up one. But what if he picks up the popular vote there and then add that in? Because then you'll see a whole different outcome.
Well, there's all kinds of options. There's all kinds of outcomes, and it's probably going to go down to the wire. I'm going to miss talking about it on the roundtable. We won't have a Reardon roundtable this week because Ryan will be here, but certainly this is not going away anytime soon. I got this to do here.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right, well, this one's a little involved, and I played some of this earlier, but there is a mother that was at a hearing on Homeland Security. Patty Moran is his name. Rachel was her daughter, 35-year-old daughter, who was brutally murdered by a migrant. So she testified before this panel earlier today.
They say that the borders are safe. We live 1,800 miles away from the southern border. They're not safe. They're not safe. If you have a sanctuary city in your state, you're not safe.
Yeah, that's why immigration and illegal immigration goes well past the borders down in Mexico, for
sure. She's the American mom, and she's not the only one in our cities that have been murdered. There was another murder by an illegal immigrant from El Salvador that happened a year before, and that person was just pleaded guilty to 4 murders, 2 rapes, and numerous other crimes. They are bringing criminals into our country. They are allowing them into our smallest towns, and our people are dying.
Now, at that hearing with Patty Moran and others was this, I don't know who this guy is, David Hathaway. He's from Arizona. And the Democrats must have bribed him to go up there and say ridiculous things.
And I hate to say that, I hate to use the R word, but it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the racism word. There's a xenophobic aspect to this. There was never a proposal to build a wall on the northern border, on the Canadian border. There was never any intent to aggressively enforce Title 42 on the Canadian border. So, you know, there is this kind of racist component to it that we kind of all ignore, but it's there smoldering in the background.
Do I, ladies and gentlemen, we have a smart, we have a very informed audience. I met many of you or, you know, was reacquainted with you at the debate watch party. Do I need to even spend one moment on how idiotic that statement was that that guy just said? He's trying to compare what's happening through the southern border with all of Central America and South America and Mexico with Canada. Right. I mean, the Canadians might be crossing over here because they can't take Pierre Trudeau or Justin Trudeau, but it's not even close. And that's the Democrats' witness. That was the best that they could do, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Oopsie, I think I hit the wrong one. And that's happened a little bit just because we have different equipment here and we're changing studios. Thankfully for me, this is all going to be done by tomorrow, so I'll be back in the regular studio on Monday. We'll see you then.
Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon KFTK and Instagram at Mark Talk. You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show. Get more at 971talk.com.